The difference from a person and angel is easy. Most of an angel is on the inside and most of a person is on the outside.
If you get like Mr. God, you don't know you are, do you? Are what? I questioned. Good and kind and loving. This last comment was delivered in her throwaway tone of voice, as if it were insignificant and irrelevant. I knew this one of old. Either you had to pretend it hadn't happened or start asking questions. A moment or two of hesitation on my part as I watched the grin spread from her toes and explode in one short, sharp hoot of mirth, and I realized she had sprung her trap. She had something to say and had forced me into asking the question. If I hadn't done it, sooner or later, if I hadn't done it then, I would have had to sooner or later, so, okay, Tick, what's all this goodness and kindness and loving lark then? Well? And the tone of her voice slid down the roller coaster of excitement, shot up the other side, and took off. Well, if you think you are, you ain't. From my position at the bottom of this particular class, I asked, how come? I thought I got the drift of this conversation and reckoned I was waiting for her about two steps ahead. She had signaled a right turn and I was waiting for her. But suddenly she took a left-handed U-turn and sped back against oncoming arguments. Thrown off balance by this sudden switch, I could do no more than walk back to where she was waiting. Right. Give, I said.
You don't expect Mr. God knows he's good and kind and loving, do you?
I don't suppose I had ever given this a moment's thought. But put like that, there was only one answer to give, even though I wasn't convinced of the truth of it. I guess not, I replied with some hesitation. The question why got stuck somewhere between my brain box and my vocal cords. I should have known that this whole conversation was leading to some conclusion, some idea, some statement that satisfied her completely. She gathered herself, holding her excitement in check. Suddenly, with an explosive gasp, she said,
Mr. God don't know he's good and kind and loving. Mr. God is empty.
Now, I'll accept that the stone that bruises my toe isn't really there. I don't mind entertaining the idea that everything is an illusion, but that Mr. God is empty simply goes against the grain. It stands to reason that Mr. God is full of knowing, full of love, full of compassion. You name it, he is full of it. Why, God is like some gigantic Christmas stocking full of good presents, inexhaustible, showering untold and unnumbered presents upon his children. Damnation, of course he's full. That's what I was taught, and that's how it was. Or was it? I got no more from Anna that day or for several days after. I stewed in my own juice. The idea that Mr. God was empty milled around in my brain. Of course, it was ridiculous, but it just stuck there. As a picture formed in my mind, I got more and more embarrassed and more ashamed. I hadn't seen this picture with such clarity before, but there it was. Mr. God all dressed up in a dress suit, top hat, and a wand producing rabbits out of a hat. You put your hand and asked for a motor car or 1,000 pounds or what you will, and Mr. God waved his magic wand and out it all came. In the end, I saw my picture of Mr. God, a kindly, benevolent, and bewhiskered magician. A few days later, after a lot of wondering, I asked the question that had puzzled me for days. Tick, what's this Mr. God being empty stuff? She turned to me eagerly. I distinctly got the impression that she had waited for this question for days but could do nothing until I'd seen my picture of Mr. God, the great magician.
When the world went all red through the bit of glass and the color from the flower.
I remembered that all right. We had talked about transmitted light and reflected light, the light took on the color of the glass through which it was transmitted. The color of the yellow flower was due to reflected light. We had seen the colors of the spectrum with the aid of a prism. We had looked at Newton's colored spinning disk and had mixed all the colors of the spectrum back to white again. I had explained that the yellow flower absorbed all the colors of the spectrum with the exception of yellow, which was reflected back to the viewer. Anna had digested this bit of information for a while and had come back with,
oh, yellow is the bit it don't want.
And after a little pause,
so its real color is all the bits it do want.
I couldn't argue with this since I couldn't be sure what the heck a flower would want anyway. All these bits of information had been taken in, mixed with various bits of colored glass, shaken well, and worked into her particular framework. It seemed that each and every individual was issued at birth with various bits of glass labeled good, bad, nasty, etc., etc. People got in the habit of slipping these bits of glass over their inward eye and seeing things according to the color and label of the glass. This we did, I was given to understand, in order to justify our inner convictions. Now, Mr. God was a bit different from a flower. A flower didn't want the yellow light and was called yellow by us because that's what we saw. You couldn't say the same thing about Mr. God. Mr. God wanted everything, so we didn't reflect anything back. Now, if Mr. God didn't reflect anything back, we couldn't possibly see him, could we? So as far as we were concerned, as far as we were able to understand what Mr. God was, we simply had to admit that Mr. God was quite empty. Not empty because there was truly nothing there, but empty because he accepted everything. Because he wanted everything and did not reflect anything back. Of course, you could cheat if you wanted to. You could wear your bit of colored glass marked, Mr. God is loving, or your bit marked, Mr. God is kind. But then, of course, you would miss the whole nature of Mr. God. Just imagine what kind of an object Mr. God must be if he accepts everything, if he reflects absolutely nothing back. This, Anna said, is being a real God. This is what we were being asked to do, to throw away our pieces of colored glass and see clearly.
Hi, my name is Brandy, and I am very excited to be here today sharing with you my favorite book, Mr. God, This is Anna. It's a bit of a funny story how this book and I found each other. I had to do a book report in ninth grade, and I chose it for a couple reasons. I borrowed my teacher's copy because first it was based on a true story, and at this time I had a lot of questions about God, and I thought maybe it would have some interesting answers. The thing is, I am a bit of a procrastinator, so I didn't leave enough time to both read the book and write the report, so I had to pick one. So being the very practical person I am, I chose to write the report. I read the first page and the last page, and I made up all of the rest and wrote this 3-page report on Mr. God, This is Anna. I got a 98. I learned a couple things. First, probably my teacher hadn't read the book, or she hadn't read my report. And second, maybe I should consider a career in writing. But not only did I not read the book, but I sort of neglected to give it back to her. Basically, I stole the book. Months after graduation, like, I found it in my belongings, and I was like, I owe it to her to read this book. And so I think that was probably her plan all along. You guys, this book changed my life. From Anna, I learned that often the questions are more important than the answers, and that stories and exploration can change the world. So my husband Jermaine pointed out that our church is set up pretty well for a sermon based on a book. Some of the readings, like the one I just read, are a bit long. There's only a couple more, by the way. The good news is we have bagels and coffee and donuts right outside, and you can eat them in the sanctuary, which is honestly the real reason I come here. So what I'm about to read is the first page of the book, exactly half of what I read in ninth grade. The difference from a person and an angel is easy. Most of an angel is in the inside, and most of a person is on the outside. These are the words of 6-year-old Anna, sometimes called Mouse, Hum, or Joy. At 5 years, Anna knew absolutely the purpose of being, knew the meaning of love, and was a personal friend and helper of Mr. God. At 6, Anna was a theologian, mathematician, philosopher, poet, and gardener. If you asked her a question, you would always get an answer, in due course. On some occasions, the answer would be delayed for weeks or months, but eventually, in her own good time, the answer would come, direct, simple, and much to the point. So the book is narrated by a guy named Finn, and we don't get more than that. We don't get a first name or last name, depending on how you look at it. He is this 19-year-old kid, is a big dude, wandering the foggy docks of London late at night in the 1930s, drinking beer and eating hot dogs. And it's on one of these excursions that he meets Anna. And Finn believes that she is as much full-blooded child as part angel. And it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly that she's run away from wherever she came from. And wherever that was, it was an abusive environment. Finn lives at home with his mom and an interesting cast of characters, because his mom has a habit of taking in waifs and strays and helping people get back on their feet. So Anna comes to live with them, and at first I think they're trying to figure out like what to do with her, like what's the right thing to do, but eventually she basically becomes like family, and she lives with them for a couple of years. Finn specifically is trying to figure out, you know, what is his role with Anna? Is he a father? Is he a brother? Is he a friend? And in the process of trying to figure that out, he sort of like lets her, whatever entertain, like whatever she fancies, he's all about it. So she sort of gets this brilliant DIY education. We might call it homeschool, but it was just, you know, they're looking at all kinds of interesting things. And for Anna, everything leads back to Mr. God. Everything is, if you listen to it, has something to say about God, and everything is a way for God to tell us about himself. Side note, obviously the name of the book, she uses masculine pronouns, so I'm going to today, even though I personally believe that God represents both genders. So this next passage, I call the mirror book passage, and there's about to be a mirror book image up there, and that's sort of what it is. It allows you to see objects from multiple points of view at the same time and makes ordinary objects extraordinary. One evening, it was suggested that the mirror book was something more. It was a miracle book. Mr. Weekly's dictionary told us that mirror came from the Latin mirari, to wonder at, and miracle came from the Latin mirus, wonderful. We knew that Mr. God had made man in his own image. So could it be? Was it possible? He might have made a big mirror, Finn. What would he want to do that for? I don't know, but he might have. Could be. Perhaps we're on the other side. How come the other side? Perhaps we're the wrong way around. That's a thought, Tick. That's why we get it all wrong. Yeah, that's why we get it all wrong. Like numbers. Like numbers. Yes, the numbers in the mirror. How's that? Them numbers in the mirror, them numbers is takeaway numbers, not add numbers. Don't get you, Tick. What are you driving at? Anna took a paper and pencil and wrote 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Them is add numbers, she pronounced. If you put a looking glass on 0, and then the numbers come out, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. They're takeaway numbers. I was following the argument so far. The reflected numbers were takeaway numbers, she continued. People are takeaway people. Hold it. I put out a hand. I don't get this takeaway stuff. She hopped off the chair and staggered back with an armful of books. Settling herself once again on the chair, she thumped the table once or twice. That's 0, she informed me. That's 0, and that's the looking glass. Right, I've got that bit. That's the mirror. I gave the table a thump. So what's next? She placed a book on the table. That's add 1, she explained, looking hard at me. I nodded. She placed a second book on top of the first. That's add 2. I nodded some more. That's add 3. That's add 4. The pile grew higher and higher. When she was satisfied that I'd grasped exactly what she was saying, an armful knocked over all the books, and she swept them onto the floor. Now, we were obviously coming to the difficult bit. Where, she asked, is a takeaway book? The question was asked with a hand on her hip and her head tilted. Search me, I answered. I haven't got it. Again, she thumped the table a couple of times. Down there, it's down there. Oh, sure, I replied, it's down there. I had not much idea where there referred to, and said so. A takeaway one book is a hole as big as a book. A takeaway two books is a hole as big as two books. It's not hard, she said.
It wasn't, not when you got the hang of things. So I plunged in with, so a takeaway 8 books number is a hole as big as 8 books. She continued in her tutorial way. If you've got takeaway 10 books whole, and you've got 15 ad books, how many books you got? I began to tip the 15 ad books down the hole one by one and watch them disappear. I lost 10 that way and ended up with 5. 5, I announced. But what's that got to do with takeaway people? I shrank about 4 feet under her sympathetic gaze and just managed to stop myself falling down the takeaway hole. If, she underlined, people are looking glass people, then they're takeaway people. It's all pretty obvious, so obvious that it would take an idiot not to see it. We all know that Mr. God made man in his own image, and the images are found in mirrors. Mirrors turned you back to front or left to right. Images were takeaway things. So putting it all together, Mr. God was and Mr. God is on one side of the mirror. Mr. God was on the ad side. We were on the other side of the mirror, so we were on the takeaway side. We ought to have known that. When Mom puts the toddler down and backs off a few paces, she does so in order to encourage the toddler to walk to her. So did Mr. God. Mr. God puts you down on the takeaway side of the mirror and then asks you to find your way to the ad side of the mirror. You see, he wants you to be like him. Takeaway people live in holes, must do, I admitted. What sort of holes? Different holes? Well, that accounts for it. How are they different? Some big, some little, she continued, all with different names, such as. She walked around the holes, reading off the names as she went. Greedy, wicked, cruel, liar, etc., etc. On our side of the looking glass, the whole place was littered with holes of various depths with people living at the bottom. On Mr. God's side were appropriate piles of whatever, ready to fill up the holes if only we got the sense to ask for them. The piles also had names like generosity, kindness, and truth. The more you filled up the hole, your hole, the nearer to Mr. God's side of the mirror you got. If you managed to fill up your hole and still have some left, why then you are well and truly on the way to the ad side, Mr. God's side. You'll understand, of course, that Mr. God looks into his mirror and sees us all, but that we can't see Mr. God. I mean, after all, a mirror image can't see what it's looking at. As Anna said, your face reflection can't see you, can it? Occasionally, Mr. God sees fit to do something about somebody's hole. He sort of fills it up for them. That's what we call a miracle. Okay, so I wanted to unpack the first reading I did, the bit of glass, and the mirror book reading. 3 things come to mind. First, what Richard Rohr calls the true self. Second, vulnerability. And third, systems versus goals. So, first, the true self. So, in the first passage, if you remember, Anna called God empty because, and we might say invisible, but empty because he accepts everything and reflects nothing back. And that's what we are being called to do, to throw off our bits of glass and see clearly. Now, if our pieces of glass are the parts of us that you see, that's our identity. So like our hair color, profession, the books that I have in my home, what I choose to share on Instagram, I could go on and on. What's interesting is that most of these things aren't inherently bad. They're just temporary. They're the parts of us that will eventually go away. Richard Rohr wrote a book called A Mortal Diamond, and he talks about what Anna calls pieces of glass, he calls your false self. Not false because it's wrong, but false because it's temporary. And he says the opposite of the false self is the true self. The part of you, your immortal diamond, the part that is eternal, everlasting, the part that is like God. I think the heart of the Christian journey is this continuous shedding of our bits of glass, of our false self, and over time becoming more and more like God. But we live in a world that's constructed by false selves. It's our armor. It's how we don't get slaughtered by the world. To take that stuff off, is incredibly vulnerable. Now, Anna describes God as empty. In
invisible. He reflects nothing. He accepts everything and reflects nothing back. That kind of radical acceptance is a little bit scandalous. When we grow, when we learn something new and we decide that we don't believe that thing that we used to believe anymore, we often look back at that thing with disdain. Like, I cannot believe I used to think that. Like, that was crazy. But what can happen is that can become another piece of glass. I think what we're being asked to do is throw all of it away and accept who we were, who we are, and who we are becoming. And at the same time, accept and honor other people on their journey, no matter how many bits of glass they have. That sounds nice, but practically speaking, like, what does that even look like? So I read an article the other day in Inc.com called by Jeff Hayden, called An Almost Foolproof Way to Achieve Every Goal You Set, because full disclosure, success or the pursuit of is not a bit of glass I'm ready to throw away just yet. And in it, he talks about a systems approach versus a goals approach. So if my goal as a writer is to write a book, then my system is to have my butt in the computer chair typing away every day, you know, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m., Monday through Friday. If you want to run a marathon, then your goal is the crossing the finish line, but your system actually has nothing to do with the finish line. It's the training schedule that you work, you know, to get there. If our goal is to be like God, then our system is the tiny little things we do, the little decisions we make every day that help us to become more accepting of ourselves and each other. Okay, so the next reading that I'm going to read is toward the end of the book. Their friend Skipper has just passed away, and so Finn is, we don't really hear much about that, but Finn is awakened by a cry coming from Anna's room. That night, after Skipper's funeral, I was wakened by a cry of despair from behind the curtain. I went to Anna and cradled her in my arms. A nightmare was my first thought, or perhaps grief from Skipper. I rocked her gently in my arms and made those kinds of noises that made it all right again. I was holding her tightly for comfort, but she fought her way out of my arms and stood on the bed. I was a bit scared and lost at this turn of events and didn't quite know what to do. I lit the gas. Something seemed to go bad inside me. Anna was standing on the bed, her eyes wild and wide, tears streaming down her cheeks, both hands pressed over her mouth as if to stifle a scream. It seemed that all the familiar objects in the room suddenly raced away to infinity and the world dissolved into formlessness. I tried to say something, but nothing came. It was one of those senseless moments. My mind was racing around in circles, but my body wasn't in gear. I tried to do something, but my body was frozen. What really frightened me was that Anna didn't see me. I wasn't there for her. I couldn't help her. I cried. I don't know if I cried for her or for myself. Whatever reason, the miseries took over. Suddenly, out of my tear-filled void, I heard Anna's voice. Please, please, Mr. God, please teach me how to ask real questions. Oh, please, Mr. God, help me to ask real questions. For a moment of eternity, I saw Anna as a flame and shuddered as I grasped the uniqueness of being me. How I managed that moment, I shall never know, for my strength was not equal to it. In some strange, mysterious way, I saw for the first time. Suddenly, there was a hand on my face, soft and gentle, a hand wiping away my tears and a voice saying, Finn, Finn. The room began to reassemble again. Things were once more. Finn, what are you crying for? Asked Anna. I don't know why. Perhaps it was just plain fear. But I began to swear, coldly and efficiently. Every muscle in my body ached and trembled. Anna's lips were on mine, her arm around my neck. Don't swear, Finn. It's all right. It's all right. I was trying to make some sort of sense out of that awful, beautiful moment, trying to get back to normality again.
It was like climbing down an unending ladder. Anna was talking again. "I'm glad you came, Finn," she whispered. "I love you, Finn." I wanted to say me too, but nothing happened. In some curious way, I seemed to be facing two ways at once. I wanted to be back among the familiar objects that I knew so well, and at the same time, I wanted to experience that moment again. From the middle of my fog of confusion, I realized that I was being led back to bed, utterly exhausted. I lay there, trying to make some sense of it all, trying to find some starting point from which I could begin to ask questions. But the words didn't seem to fit together in any reasonable pattern. It was a cup of tea in my hand that started the world turning again. "Drink it, Finn. Drink it all up." Anna was sitting on the bed wearing my old blue sweater over her pajamas. She had made the tea, hot and sweet, one for each of us. I heard the scrape of a match on the matchbox and Anna splutter as she lit a cigarette for me and stuck it between my lips. I got myself up on my elbow. "What happened, Finn?" asked Anna. "God knows," I said. "Were you asleep?" "Been awake for a long time." "I thought you were having a nightmare," I muttered. "No," she smiled. "I was saying my prayers. The way you was crying, I thought, that why you cried?" "I don't know. I suppose so." It sort of got kind of empty all of a sudden. It was funny. I thought I was looking at myself for a moment. Painful. She didn't answer for a moment, and then very quietly she said, "Yes, I know." I was too tired to prop myself up any longer, and suddenly I found myself with my head resting on Anna's arm. It didn't seem right. It ought to have been the other way around, but it wasn't, and I realized I liked it. It was what I wanted. We stayed like that for a long time, but there were questions I wanted to ask her. "Tick," I said, "what were you asking God about real questions for?" "Oh, it's just sad, that's all." "What's sad?" "People is." "I see. What's sad about people?" "People ought to get more wise when they grow older. Bossy and Patch do, but people don't." "Don't you think so?" I asked. "No. People's boxes get littler and littler." "Boxes? I don't understand." "Questions are in boxes," she explained, "and the answers they get only fit inside the box." "That's difficult. Go on a bit." "It's hard to say. It's like the answers are the same size as the box. It's like them dimensions." "Oh?" "If you ask a question in two dimensions, then the answer is in two dimensions too. It's like a box. You can't get out." "I think I see what you mean. The questions get to the edge and then they stop. It's like a prison." "I expect we're all in some sort of prison." She shook her head. "No, Mr. God wouldn't do that." "I suppose not. What's the answer then?" "Let Mr. God be. He lets us be. Don't we?" "No, we put Mr. God in little boxes." "Surely we don't do that." "Yes, all the time, because we really don't love him. We gotta let Mr. God be free. That's what love is." Anna searched for Mr. God, and her desire was for a better understanding of him. Anna's search for Mr. God was serious but gay, earnest but lighthearted, reverent but impudent, and single-minded and multi-tracked. Not that she doubted God's existence for a moment, but it was for some time a sign that he did exist. By the same token, a bus or a flower was also a sign that he existed. How she came by this vision of pearl of great price, I do not know. Certainly was with her before I met her. It was just my luck that I happened to be with her when she was doing her working out. To listen to her was exhilarating, like flying on one's own. To watch her was to be startled into seeing. Evidence for Mr. God? Why, there was nowhere you could look. There wasn't evidence for Mr. God. It was everywhere. Everything was evidence for Mr. God. It was at that point things tended to get out of hand. The evidence could be arranged in too many ways. People who accepted one sort of arrangement were called by one particular name. Arrange the evidence in a new way and you were called by a different name. Anna reckoned that the number of possible arrangements of the available evidence might easily run into squillions of names. The problem was further complicated by the fact of synagogues, mosques, temples, churches, and all other different places of worship. And scientific laboratories were not excluded from the list. By any reasonable standards of thinking and behavior, nobody could, with their hand on their heart, honestly say that these other people were not worshiping and loving God, even if they did call him by some other name like truth. Okay. That is a lot. There's a lot there. For me, it's a little jarring,
because he has this kind of out-of-body experience. It's very emotional. And then he moves from that to talking like an almost theological discussion of Anna's views of the like possibilities with different religions. But whether you agree with Anna's assessment of the different religions, I think for me two things stick out in this passage. First, her plea to God to ask real questions, and the almost accusation or like sad resignation that as people grow older, not all of us grow wiser. And I wanted to talk about that because I thought that before, and it's actually a fear of mine that, you know, as I grow old, I'm not gonna grow up. But what is interesting to me is that you have Anna, a 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old who has real wisdom, and there's no denying this. And if you have ever, I'm sure if you have kids or if you've ever been around kids for any length of time, they say the most amazing things. But if you if you're on Facebook or Twitter or cable TV, like dance moms, I think it's easy to see that we are not asking the real questions. But I love Anna's solution because she doesn't focus on anyone else. She asks God to help her ask the real questions. And so that is my prayer. So this next part is the hard bit of the talk. If you've read the book, then you already know this. And I don't think it's a spoiler because Finn actually says it on the second page. But Anna dies. She is 7 years old, and she is trying to save a cat from a tree, and she slips. And she lives a couple days after that, but she doesn't make it. And I cry every time I read it. And every time you wish it ends differently. I hope by some magic, like it will be different this time. And it's one of those things when a little kid dies, when a loved one passes away, when something horrific happens, you end up asking, how on earth could God let this happen? And Finn actually has a really hard time with it. For 5 years, he considers God like a moron. He can't deal with it. He does eventually come to terms with it. He goes to visit her grave, and it's covered in poppies, and he's filled with this sense of peace that she's home. But those 5 years are brutal, and they remind me of this part in Immortal Diamond, which I mentioned earlier, that I'm going to read a little bit from. What I think, what I hope, is the heart of this talk, and it's God as the great allower. In this regard, God is the great allower. Despite all attempts of ego, culture, and even religion to prevent God from allowing, show me where God does not allow. God lets women be hurt and hurt women conceive. God lets tyrants succeed, and God lets me make my own mistakes again and again. He does not enforce his own commandments. God's total allowing of everything has, in fact, become humanity's major complaint. If we were truly being honest, God is both a scandal and a supreme disappointment to most of us. We would prefer a God of domination and control to a God of allowing, as most official prayers make clear. Both God and the true self need only to fully be themselves and generously show themselves. Then the major work is done. The source will always flow out through and toward those who want it. I would go so far as to define God as a deep allowing to the point of scandalous cooperation with evil, both natural disasters and human evils. To allow yourself to be grabbed and held by such a divine wholeness is a dark and dangerous risk. And yet this is exactly what we mean by salvation. We are allowing the great allower to allow us, even at our worst. We gradually learn to share in the divine freedom and must forgive God for being far too generous. What Rohr calls the great allower, God as a great allower, Anna has a bit of a different take. Anna considers God a sweetie. Anna saw, recognized, admitted to, and submitted to all those attributes of God so often discussed.
Mr. God was the author of all things, the creator of all things, omnipotent, omnipotent, the very heart of all things, except. It was this exception that Anna saw as the key to the whole thing. This exception was funny, exciting, and made Mr. God the sweetie he was. What puzzled Anna was that nobody had seen it before. At least, if they had seen it, nobody seemed willing to talk about it. It was very odd, since for Anna, it was so strange a thing that only Mr. God could have thought about it. All the other qualities of Mr. God, those qualities so often talked about in church and school, were magnificent, tremendous, and, let's face it, a little frightening. Then he had gone and done this thing. It made him lovable, funny, giggly. You could, if you wish, deny that Mr. God existed, but then any denial didn't alter the fact that Mr. God was. No, Mr. God was. He was the kingpin, the center, the very heart of things. And this is where it got funny. You see, we had to recognize that he was all these things. That meant that we were at our own center, not God. God is our center, and yet it is we who acknowledge that he's the center. That makes us somehow internal to Mr. God. This is the curious nature of Mr. God, that even while he's at the center of all things, he waits outside us and knocks to come in. It is we who open the door. Mr. God doesn't break it down and come in. No, he knocks and waits. Now, it takes a real super kind of God to work that one out, but that's just what he's done. As Anna said, that's very funny, that is. It makes me very important, don't it? Fancy Mr. God taking second place. Anna never got involved in the problem of free will. I suppose she was too young, but she had got to the heart of the matter. Anna, or Mr. God, took second place. Ain't that something? So, I was trying to figure out how to end the talk, and we happened upon this song by Sarah Groves. And I'm not a musician, but my husband is. And so we thought the best way to end is this song where Sarah Groves asks the simple question, what do I know?
Shared with me that she's afraid of dying. I sit here years from her experience and try to bring her comfort. I try to bring her comfort. But what do I know? What do I know? She grew up singing about the glory land, and she would testify how Jesus changed her life. It was easy to have faith when she was 34, but now her friends are dying. Death is at her door. And what do I know? What do I know? Well, I don't know that there are harps in heaven or the process of earning your wings. I don't know of bright lights at the ends of tunnels or any of these things. She lost her husband after 60 years, and as he slipped away, she still had things to say. Death can be so inconvenient. You try to live in love, it comes and interrupts. And what do I know? What do I know? Well, I don't know that there are harps in heaven. process for earning your wings. I don't know of bright lights at the ends of tunnels or any of these things. But what do I know? What do I know? Well, I don't know that there are harps in heaven or the process for earning your wings. I don't know of bright lights at the ends of tunnels or any of but I know to be absent from this body is to be present with the Lord. And from what I know of him, that must be pretty good. But I know to be absent from this body is to be present with the Lord. And from what I know of him, that must be very good.
Hello, everybody. My name is Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here. And we're in a series at the moment on called God in the Arts, where we're looking at books, as Brandy just talked about, looking at music, different movies, different art forms that people in our community, you know, it's a different person from our community each week that's sharing with us how those pieces of art have moved them, stirred them, given them some insight perhaps into life, the universe, everything. And we use these things, you know, we take these things, these stories, if you like. I think that was what Brandy was doing this morning, taking a story, taking something that is impossible to fully explain and taking a different approach to it so that it might give us some insight. It might kind of jolt us a little bit. It's a little bit like how Jesus told parables. You know, some people think Jesus told parables to make the point really clear. Well, that's not really what happened, because most people seemed, or a lot of people were confused by Jesus' parables. Jesus told a parable to kind of spin us a bit, give us a different way of looking at something that initially might be confusing, but then as we lean into it and think about it more, it brings deeper revelation, deeper understanding. And it seems like stories and art forms are like that for us. They kind of stir us at a deeper level. And so we've probably been stirred by different things that Brandy said and Jermaine's song this morning. You know, we all come here in one sense together. We come as people who have a lot of questions, right? That book was about a lot of questions. I think Brandy started off by saying she was going to talk more about questions and answers. We come with questions. We have questions about our own lives. You know, why has this happened to me? Why am I in this situation? What does the future hold? And perhaps an even bigger question of what is this all about? What does this all mean? And we as many of us here are followers of Jesus. You know, that's what we're about at this church. And we're searching for answers to those questions. We see those answers in Jesus. But we're all together in that none of us have it worked out. And that's, I think, true for every person in this room. If you have it worked out, then please come and see me afterwards. I'd love the secret to the universe. But so we come with these questions. And so as we come to communion now, this is what we do at this point in our service. There's something very unifying about this, and we say this very often here, we should say it every week, that everybody is welcome to join in communion, right? Everybody is welcome to do that. We're going to take some bread and eat it, take some wine, it's actually grape juice, and we're going to drink that. And we do that because it's something that Jesus did a couple of thousand years ago at a particularly momentous occasion in his life. It was actually very near his death. It was the night before he went to his death, and he had his immediate friends around him. And he used an ancient Jewish ceremony that they were in at that time, the Passover, and he used elements of that ceremony, the bread and the wine, to talk about something very intimate, very personal. And he really gave himself at that moment to his followers. And we see Jesus giving himself to us by extension every time we do this. And this is somewhat ceremonious this morning when we do communion, but we could think of this every time we eat, every time we sit down and take food in, or have something to drink, we could allow it to remind us of the fact that God is with us, that Jesus is present now. And that's an incredible mystery. That's something that I don't think any of us fully understand. And so we lean into that mystery using stories and art forms and things like communion. Communion, in a sense, is a story. And we come to it with all of our stories, right? We're going to come together right now with all our joys, all our pains, all our questions, all our confusion. And we're going to lean into the mystery. And we're going to trust that in this, as we do this, and as we do this in our daily lives, that God will be revealed to us, that God would come close to us, that something will be transformed within us. So I just encourage us this morning, and again, everybody is welcome to do this. As you come and take the bread, just imagine that we're kind of taking in something of God, something of the mystery of God, something of the power of God, something other than ourselves. And as we take the wine, Jesus talked about wine, grape juice. It was wine, but you know, we use grape juice here. When Jesus took the wine and passed it around, he talked about forgiveness. In some sense, perhaps Jesus there is getting at this, the essence of this separation between God and humans, this fact that we do things that we shouldn't. That in some way, if God is perfect, we certainly aren't. And that creates some separation that God doesn't want. And as we were just hearing, God is the great allower. So God, in drinking the wine, we're allowing ourselves to be embraced by God. All the good, all the bad, letting all that bad be just cleansed and washed away. And we are being allowed. So we have these elements that are just, you know, I'll be honest with you, it's just bread, it's just wine, just grape juice. But it could be something so much more. So as we lean into communion, as we lean into the mystery of God this morning, in keeping with what Brandy has been talking to